Okay, so let us get started. Let me just begin again. My fear in doing this is that I would give any sort of impression that I am any form of an expert in this parenting business. I am not. I make plenty of mistakes. Myself, I have 5 beautiful children who will be happy to prove it to you when they're old enough to speak to their therapist. But until that point, you can ask them, even at the table just a week or two ago. One of the things we'll learn about is how we like to tell our children what they're supposed to think. How we often make that mistake. And at the table just 2 weeks ago, where I've been discussing site workshops, and we do this in our home, and one of the kids didn't want to eat their pizza, and they said it was too hot, and I said, it's not too hot. And my son looked at me and said, it's too hot for me, which is just your classic response of we're always telling them what they should think and what they should feel. And there it is at my table, and my wife looks at me. Whenever within a week of this class, she's always on top of me. She's like, oh, refresher's coming up soon, right? It's always, that's the way that it goes. So, but this is really just an opportunity for us as a group to share, learn some techniques and some tools. And the more that we do so, the better that we will be as parents, the more that we invest our time and energy into this. The better that we become, we learn new things, and it seems to work out that way. I did speak with somebody who I did this workshop a couple months ago, and I spoke with someone who was in it and loved it and said the tools were so good, and she employed them, and their house was totally different. And I spoke with her about 3 months later. I said, how are things going? And we totally reverted back to everything as if we didn't do anything. And I said to her, it occurred to me that it's amazing how naturally poor we are as parents often. Some of us are better than others, but the skills, there's a tool set, a bunch of skills that are necessary, and we're all sitting around this room. I was in your seats until I did a whole bunch of reading and sat in a bunch of classes myself, because you, like, it's overwhelming. Like, how do I get my kids to go to bed at night? How do I get them to eat dinner? How do I get them to do anything that I ask them to do? Because kids are kids, and kids, as being kids, are always pushing the limits and exploring and experimenting and trying to figure things out. And we don't necessarily naturally have all of the talents and skills. So we'll work it through. We'll see what we could, what we can do together. All right, let me begin with a book from Rav Moshe Eisman. He was here, as somebody mentioned, a few weeks ago. He's a Rebbe of mine in Neri Yisrael. He wrote a book called Of Parents and Penguins. It's a wonderful little book. He quotes a Gemara, which I will start with. And the Gemara discusses that even had the Torah not been given, there'd be certain qualities and traits that we would have learned from the animal world without having needed a Torah to be given. And he brings, the Gemara says, if the Torah not been given, we would have learned propriety from the cat. We would have learned self-sufficiency from the ant, chastity from the dove, decency from the hen. And the Gemara gives a list of traits that we would have learned. We could have looked at the animal world and determined these are the appropriate traits that we need. And he asks that there's something missing from the list. Because it doesn't say anywhere that we would have learned parenting from the animal kingdom. And he asks, title of his books, Of Parents and Penguins. Penguins, the famous emperor penguins, if any one of you or your children have watched Happy Feet, made famous the emperor penguins, they are one of the most noble animals out there as far as how and what they do to raise their children. Travel 30 to 75 miles to a mating ground. After the female lays an egg, she hands it off to her male husband, mate. She then gorges herself back on the fish, and he sits with it by himself for over 100 days. No food, no warmth, no companion, just sitting there waiting for her to come back. Finally, she returns to feed the by this time hatched egg. How come we don't learn the concept of altruism? We could learn self-sacrifice. We could learn so many things from the penguin. And it's not anywhere in the Gemara, and we don't really find anywhere in Chazal that our tools and our skills come from looking at the animal kingdom. Asks Rav Eisman, why not? So he suggests an idea, and I want to start with this because this is really going to color everything that we're going to do, that in the animal world, the concept of parenting, and you see true concepts of parenting, you see ideas, self-sacrifice, dedication, altruism, you see all of those concepts in the animal world, but it's an inborn instinct for the purpose of maintaining the species from this generation to the next generation. And the animals are created with that instinct that they're going to do whatever it takes to be able to get this species from here to there. Whatever that is, whatever self-sacrifice, giving up of themselves, whatever that is, that's what they'll do. Now, a lot of that sounds like we do that also, right? Don't we want to see that next generation? We want that to happen also. But he adds there's a much more fundamental aspect that's added when it comes to us, and that is we're part of the equation. The penguin might sacrifice himself because all he's concerned with is what's going to be with the next generation. That's the inborn instinct that they're given. That's how Hashem created them. It's not like that for us. We're part of this equation in that we grow, we change, we struggle, we have to develop. We will be different people. We should be different people now than we were before having had children. That which goes into being able to deal with the difficulties, the stress, the anger, all that goes into parenting, and it's a lot, actually has an impact on us. So that if we would look at the animal kingdom, all that we would see is give up on yourself, whatever it takes, just so that the next generation survives. It's not really true when it comes to us, because we have specific missions also, which includes our parenting. Rav David Weinberger, if anyone is, Moshe Weinberger, excuse me, is a Rav in New York. So he has a series on parenting tapes that I listened to once also, and he describes the idea that when a child is born into a family, it's not simply like up in Shemayim, you know, there's like a row of souls waiting to be born. And like just next, and like a little arm, like a punching bag, it's like going down a factory, like punch down the next neshama, and the next parent online gets that particular soul. And however it works out, like, oh, you got this one, oh, you got that one. Sometimes we look at our friends' kids and we say, oh boy, if I had that child, I'd be a really good parent. That kid I know how to handle, but my own, they like drive me crazy. I could handle that. But it doesn't work that way, that it just happens to be that you got this child, and if it just would have been, if you would have had a child a month later, you would have gotten a different one, just, you know, would have worked out that way. The Ribbono Shel Olam does it around the world that way, and every single parent, every single child that's in under our control, that we're responsible for to raise, was specifically, this child is your responsibility, all the challenges that come along with this child, and these children, this family, are for you. As part of our mission, as part of our task in becoming people. So that concept, you wouldn't want that from a penguin, because it doesn't work that way with penguins, but it does that way with parents, and all the difficulties that we have and the challenges are part of that. And I start with that because that really is part of everything that we're going to do, is how it affects us, and the modeling that's required. You know, for those who've already experienced it, I'm sure you can just pass this around while I'm beginning this introduction here. I have a cousin who, his first child was a girl. And I remember when we spoke with him, I was over and girl, and he said to me, he said, Baruch Hashem, it was a girl. I said, why? He said, I am not ready for morning minyan. I'm not ready for it. And if I would have had a boy, I would like have to start going to minyan earlier. I got to start modeling this behavior. I'm not there yet. Baruch Hashem, it's a girl. I have more time before I have to worry about going to minyan. And there's a certain insight in we do need to model the things that we say, the way that we behave, the way that we perform our mitzvahs, the way that we eat. Everything that we do, as you know, is watched like a hawk by our children. They see everything. They begin to speak the way that we speak, they use our phrases, they use our intonations, they just pick up on that stuff. And all of that is part of our job as far as developing as parents. Okay, that's it for my introduction. I'm listening from my path, I'm trimming it down and shortening my introduction. Let's get started. Okay, so the two things that I want to go through in this workshop are the tools of love and logic and favor and madness. Anybody familiar with either one of those two? A little bit, not at all, some, same as seminar. Okay, so which is fine either way. Both of them, both models, the models of love and logic, which was developed, I forgot the book upstairs, Klein and Fay. Fay and Klein are the two authors of that. They're out of Denver, Colorado. I am not formally, they have a whole program to be licensed. I'm not teaching formally their whole thing, just borrowing some of their tools. And Faber-Maslach wrote the book How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. One of my children, who I have permission from my wife to share this story, had a conversation with my wife today about their miscommunicating. And so my wife said, we need to start being able to communicate better so that we'll be able to address the situation in the future. And my child said, oh, you mean like how to talk so kids will listen and listen so kids will... So when they start reading, be careful what you leave around the house. Fair game. But yeah, that's why I had to move this out of my house. As even though I desired to keep it in the house, it just wasn't going to work anymore. Soon she'll be logging online and downloading it and listening anyway. So they both hold that they are complete programs, both Love and Logic and Favor and Mastery. This is all you need. Read our books and you'll be totally fine. I like to address them as two parts of all. This is just my personal take. Love and Logic, as we'll go through, is going to address much more reacting to situations as they occur. Things are going to happen. We need to react to them. It happens hundreds of times a day with our children. What are the tools? What are the skills? What do I need to do so that I can maintain my calm and my control as I react to my child doing X, Y, or Z? Love and Logic is a fantastic tool for that. Creating the basic atmosphere of the home, the way that we talk to our children when things are just totally fine, I'm not reacting to any particular situation, what are the words that I use, how do I hear what they're saying, how do I talk to them to get them to listen to what I'm saying, is a totally different skill set, which we'll do second. That's Faber Maslisch's approach. Ideally, I think that one's much more fundamental and much more important. The creating the general atmosphere of the home is far more important. The problem is that so many of us struggle with the daily interactions which drive us batty, so that we can't get to that because we're so busy struggling getting a kid into the bath and eating dinner and then brushing your teeth, and there's no time to have a normal conversation because none of that's going well, and by the time you sit down you're so flustered you're just not interested anymore. But I like to do that one first, Love and Logic first, just to work on that skill set as far as handling that, and then we'll get to the others. I gave you this handout. It's double-sided. The first half we'll do right now is a beautiful poem. The second side is a little workshop. So some of the feedback that I got for the first time I did it is that it would have been helpful to have had an outline, something to take notes if you're interested. If you don't want to, you don't have to. So I didn't want to give you the full outline because I find it very distracting. When there's too much to read, you just spend the whole time reading, and then you get lost, and then it's all confusing. So I gave a very brief outline. If you want to fill things in, it's totally great. If you don't want to, it's up to you. But it's there if you would like it, and you can tell me afterwards if you found it helpful or not. And before we get into it, let me just start with this poem. This is a poem by Dorothy Law Nolte. It's a famous poem. You may have seen it. She actually wrote a book, and what she did is she took this poem that she had written years and years ago, I think in the 50s she originally wrote it, and she wrote a chapter based on each one of these lines in the poem. And it's following on the introduction from Rav Eisman about how we have to have a role in the way that we impact our children. So just to read through parts of this briefly, come on in. There are some seats in the back.
We had to beat our children before.
Yeah, I understand. And one of Weinberger's tapes, I quoted Moshe Weinberger a moment ago, so on his parenting tapes, so he was talking about how everything is so stressful and so crazy, and there's no time at home to do homework with your kids, and every night you're running out to a shir, and then finally you know you come home and your kid's like, "Where are you running out right now?" "I'm running out to a parenting class so I learn how to talk to you." So why are you staying with me? "I gotta learn how to." So that's how it goes. It's all crazy. Anyway, so the poem, just so you can look at it on your own, but it's a beautiful idea. If children live with criticism, they learn to condemn. Children learn what they live. Sort of the whole book that she wrote here. Yeah. Yes, I do. Sorry.
Thank you.
They learn what they live. The way that we're going to set up our home, the way that the environment of the home, the atmosphere, the attitudes that are involved in the home, that's what the children will learn. That's what our kids will take from that, and that's what they will develop. If they live with criticism, they will learn to condemn. If they learn with hostility, they will learn to fight. If they live with fear, they will learn to be apprehensive. And all these things are the things that they pick up with from our homes. If they live with pity, they learn to feel sorry for themselves. If they live with ridicule, they learn to feel shy. If they live with jealousy, they learn to feel envy. If they live with shame, they learn to feel guilty. If they live with encouragement, they learn confidence. But if they learn live with tolerance, they learn patience, praise, they will learn appreciation, so on and so forth. I don't need to read through the whole thing out loud. It's worthwhile if you see these things almost in your children. You see the traits of apprehension, you see shyness, you see envy, you see guilt. Where are they getting that from? So a lot of times it comes from our home, and that's where we need to adjust ourselves. We need to learn, we need to grow, we need to become and create an environment that doesn't have that there can be the second half of the poem, all the positives of living with sharing, living with honesty, living with fairness. And you'll see that in your homes. If you're a home where your home is one of giving, one in which you are constantly doing chesed, one in which you're constantly hosting people, helping people, doing things like that, Your children will pick it up as if it's the most normal thing in the world. They won't think twice about it because that's just what we do. They hear, oh, someone had a baby and mom is making a meal. Daddy's running out to help with this. And it just becomes part of their life. And when they live with that, they learn it, because the best way to teach is for sure to create that environment ourselves. And that is the conclusion of the introduction. All the tools and all the skills that we're learning about is to create that, where we become the types of people where we don't get bogged down with the frustrations and the difficulties and the bad times and bad times, which are not really what we're interested in doing. Our goal as parents is not to like have a successful bedtime, dinner time routine. It's really not. It's to impart much greater values to our children. Yet what happens is it gets so difficult, so frustrating, and so exhausting that becomes almost like, were we successful tonight or not successful tonight is all about like what time do the kids get into bed, not what messages do we impart to them, not what lessons did they learn, not what quality time did I have with them. And that's normal. Normal in the sense of that's a life we're living. We're trying to work on some tools that during those times we can be more productive with our children, and they we won't feel as we walk in the door like, okay, here's tonight's battle, I'm ready. Okay. Oh, you've experienced that before? Yeah.
Yeah, we were just like, they have to get in bed by this time because we got to make it to the meeting by this time. And it was like all about like,
yeah,
time. You know.
Been there, done that. Yes. Yeah, still doing it. Okay. So let's start with love and logic. Let's start with that. Now, before we begin with love and logic, what we need to do is uproot the four most ineffective parenting techniques and strategies which we regularly apply all the time. So let's just, this is an important part of what we're going to do, is describe the four worst things that we do, or not only worst, ineffective parenting techniques, so that A, as couples, we are aware that we can point them out with each other, because we need to be unified with this, and we'll to appreciate, now that we're not in the moment, how silly and ineffective they are. Number one, this is based on the Love and Logic program. Number one is anger. We parent often when we're angry. Everyone close your eyes and raise your hand if you've ever parented when you've been angry. When I peek, I don't even have to. I know it's all true. That's how it goes. We get real frustrated, and when we're in a moment of anger, just forget it. Forget. Have you ever listened to your spouse trying to parent when they're angry? Laughable. You're not a person. You're a pushit, not a person. 2 weeks ago, literally 2 weeks ago, it was frightening. I caught myself doing this. My routine in my house is with my boys until they're in their kindergarten is, after they're toilet trained, I wake them up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom before I go to sleep, which I've discovered not only saves accidents, but it lets them sleep a lot longer in the morning because they get that extra couple hours. So that's my general routine until they're a little bit older. Wake them up, take them to the bathroom. Every once in a while, I get there too late. That's what happens to 4 and 5 year olds. Totally normal, expected. If you'd ask me on a normal day, do you ever expect, or how often would you expect your 4 and 5 year old to have had an accident before you got them at 12, 1 o'clock in the morning? Totally expect. Well, every once in a while, at the end, by the time I get there, if it's 1 o'clock in the morning and I know my alarm is going off at 6:30, I really don't have very much left to deal with an accident. I got to change the sheets. I got to clean him up and put him into new pajamas. And just... So it happened 2 weeks ago that for the second time in a short period of time, I get into the room, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, and you just right away, you walk like, oh, I have nothing left. So my poor 4-year-old child is asleep. Pick him up out of his bed, I take him to the bathroom, I say, that's it, no more accidents, you hear me, let's finish with this. And I'm taking off his pajamas, like, go put on new pajamas, and I'm trying to, he's like sleepwalking, not even awake. Tomorrow, I'm telling mommy, no drinks after 5, do you hear me? I you're talking to this Punjabi kid, and I have nothing left. Like when you're trying to parent at 1 o'clock in the morning and you have zero left in the tank, that's what it looks like any time of day. Like literally, the kid's asleep. He's got no clothing on. He's shivering. He's just had an accident, and I'm berating him as a 4-year-old. Like no more drinks tomorrow. I got it. And they're like, stop it. Like, what are you doing? But you need to sometimes stop yourself. And we do this all the time. We lose it. We lose it because we are stressed out. we are tired, often we are hungry, whatever is going on, and our kid does something which may or may not deserve it. Sometimes they actually do something which deserves it, but sometimes it's really just regular kid stuff. And when you are angry, you're not a human. Forget about not a parent. You have to be aware of that. My wife has gotten accustomed. She will often say to me, she's saying, here's the tizaher min akas, careful from anger, as I'm trying to implement any one of these beautiful tools, but when anger creeps in, it just destroys the whole thing. You have to be aware of that, that when you're parenting out of anger, you will not be effective, you will not be helpful, your child will not learn anything positive other than to fear you. And it is a natural human response to get angry. The Rambam writes, we need to get rid of that. It's a horrible trait and there's no place for it, but it happens. And when we get angry, you have to recognize it and drop it. Leave the room, leave the child. You're not effective, and just recognize that. We say ridiculous things, yeah.
For me, what I'm trying to do is differentiate the fact whether or not, and I hope this comes out clearly, whether I'm in my adult or in my child. Like, I feel like if I'm being frustrated and angry with them, I'm not being in my adult.
Right, you're being like a child.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and children don't parent children very well.
Right.
I have learned.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, number two, warnings. Anyone ever hear issue a warning to their child? Usually sounds something like, okay, you have until I count to three. One. Two. Has anyone found great success with this method? Has anyone used this method before? Yeah. I mean, does it work?
Sometimes.
Okay.
So, recommends that.
So when
I hit three, I go right into anger.
Yeah.
I feel much better.
Well, it works. Usually we have this thing. I tell three, or I give them a choice. If you don't do this by a count of three, you're gonna be there. You're gonna do that. You're not gonna get this. So I say one, two, and then he does it by three, or he gets the consequence.
Okay. So we'll get that. Okay.
Not phased by it.
Okay. So now, why is your child not phased by it?
I don't know, because even if we follow through, she's still not
saying. So either sometimes there is no follow through. Very often, I've seen this, I've done it, I've heard it around, like, you know, like, well, count to three, and then you get to three, and then you do, like, something else, like another count to three. I happen to believe, I personally believe that the decimal system was created by a parent who got stuck at two, and created 2.1, 2.2. That's just my personal belief where that came from, but I don't know if that's true or not. But it usually doesn't work because we either don't want to follow up. We don't know what the what if is going to be. That often is what happens. And the child either learns fear sometimes. And if it's effective, very often I have found in my experience and watching it happen in shul, it's usually not a very long-term effective method. So love and logic hold this in the top four of things that are ineffective. Number three is very similar, the threat. Good old-fashioned threat. It's really just a warning with an added consequence, which very often threats come out of a place where we're pretty angry already when we're offering the threat or very frustrated. Sometimes the threat is half-decent. Very often it's absolutely ludicrous. Something along the lines of, if you don't come here now, you'll never... Anything is ridiculous, right? You'll never get around until you'll never go to the park again. You'll never have a play date. And there's some form of a threat, which even if we can carry it through, very often we don't want to. I can never buy my child a toy again. So the children often pick up that there's really very little teeth behind threats. And generally, when we're threatening, we're not coming from a good place that we're issuing that kind of threat. We've pretty much lost it. And what really has happened is that the child is in control. In that we have nothing. We're like totally helpless against this little three-year-old who has got us wrapped around their little finger. And we have to resort to like bringing out our big guns as parents of, if you do not listen to me now, I will, and then you list it. So it's really a real authority concept of, I am far bigger than you, far greater, meaner, tougher, that I will impose my will upon you, whether you like it or not, and therefore you will do what I say now. Now, either we have to do that because we're going to carry out the threat, which doesn't create a great relationship between us and our children. It's not real, and none of us would like it if we, in our jobs, our boss would come up with that kind of ploy to get us to work a little bit better. You know, do this or you're fired. I mean, it might get us to do it, but how do you feel about your boss at the end of the day? How much do you want to work for your boss? How much do you really want to be productive? Or do you just want to avoid getting hit with that again. So as far as what we're really after, which is not the behavior as much as the relationship, this is our child, this is our precious commodity that we want to develop a relationship for, when we catch ourselves issuing threats and warnings, we've really lost control of the situation and we're trying to resort to our being bigger and better and badder than this little three-year-old to get them to do what we want, and we're not in a good parenting place. It's just not where we want the relationship to be that we need to resort to. You're all thinking, well, how else? I got my kid in the park and not leaving with me. All right, well, we'll get to that. We're just starting. But when we resort to threats, we're not in a good place. The relationship is not going to really work out very well. And lastly, and those of you with younger kids have not gone to this yet, some as they're beginning to get a little bit older already, by second or third grade, I have found myself doing this, lectures. Do you know why you need to brush your teeth? Let me tell you why you need to brush your teeth. Because do you know how much it costs to put on braces and what cavities cost per cavity? And I work hard. If you sit down and you start talking like that to your little child, you know that their eyes roll to the back of their head real fast. And they're like, and if you just, even as you get older and you think back to your grade school or high school ages, if you've ever had to be sat down by a parent or a teacher and you get a lecture, you like the second they open up their mouth, what are you doing? You are totally checked out, figuring out a way either to make fun, get back at, ignore it. You are not listening to a lecture. Now, those of the younger kids probably haven't really done this yet, but if you catch yourself lecturing to your child, they're not, oh, yeah, oh, I get it, brushing teeth because you have to pay for my... Got it, Dad. That was well said. I'm on it. Let me go head into the bathroom right now and take care of that. It doesn't work that way. I mean, maybe for you it does. I haven't experienced that with any of mine, and I don't expect that ever to happen. It doesn't work with my congregants. It doesn't work with my children. It's not the way. In colleges, maybe you can lecture, but not generally as far as in parenting. So those four things, when you catch yourself doing that, is it too cold in here, by the way? Did I drop this? Okay. When you catch yourself in anger, giving warnings, threats, or giving lectures, as far as developing that kind of relationship, as that goes, not the best place you want to be in, very often totally ineffective, more than just not being in the place that you'd want to be in as far as being a parent. All right, so what do we have left if you take away from most parents and a cold turkey? Okay, no more warnings, no more threats, no more lectures, and no more anger. What do I got? How do I get my child to do anything? That's the only method I've been using until now. And it's either worked or hasn't worked, but I mean, you survived. So what's left after that? So love and logic would go with posit the following. Those of you who are familiar with this will... good question?
No, she's looking at me. She's looking for an answer. I don't have an answer. I use all four of them.
Okay, so there, love and logic have two major guiding principles. Two guiding principles, and I'm presenting it a little bit different than the way they do, but I'm hoping to be honest. I welcome anybody to listen to their lectures available on tape. There's a woman in Dallas, a Rebbetzin, Becky Udman. Her husband is the principal of the Torah Day School of Dallas, the local elementary school there. She is a love and logic guru, expert trained with everybody, and she lectures around the country. She actually came here, I think it was 2 years ago, and gave a talk on it. She has a series of tapes and CDs which are excellent also. She presents it from a Jewish perspective. Again, this is my presentation of it. It's based on their principles, but I don't want to claim that it's exactly the way that they present it. Guiding principle number one, understand well what you can and cannot control in your children's behavior. This sounds very simple, but you'd be amazed at how we function without this piece of information. Can you control if your child will have a temper tantrum? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you?
No.
You can?
But I cheated. I listened to this good.
The answer is no. You cannot control whether or not your child's going to have a temper tantrum. Your child will have one if he or she so desires, and will not have one if he or she so desires. You can't control that. Can you control whether or not your child will take a bath?
Yes.
Right? So here's a good one. Technically speaking, the answer is yes, because most of you have children who are still at the size you can physically pick the child up and put him or her in the bath. Can you control whether or not your child will take a bath willingly, without a fight, or with like World War III? No, you can't control that. I mean, the child's going to put up a, the child's going to put up a fight. You can't. If you're fighting with your child to take a bath, you've already lost. That's not a battle you can win because you're fighting a three-year-old. We lose when we fight three-year-olds and four-year-olds and five-year-olds and ten-year-olds. It's a losing battle. So if what you need to do is, if you're at that point where you're physically picking up a child and putting them in the bath, you've really already lost the battle. And from my own personal experience, I can tell you, every single time I've done that, and I've done it many times, I'm angry. I'm not able to, when it's, because it's already been a battle. I've clearly been asking several times already, and I've been rejected each time. And then the line is drawn. I'm not, this is me previous to this. That's it. Grab the child, put them in there. They're yelling, screaming, thrashing around. I'm angry. They're not happy. This is a non-productive situation. Can you control whether or not your child will get dressed in the morning or brush their teeth? Not really. They're going to put up a fight. They're going to put up a fight. Have you ever tried brushing the teeth of a child who's clenched their teeth and their lip? And you're like drawing blood already because they won't open up, but they need to brush their teeth. Doesn't work so well. Can you control your child's attitude? Whether or not they're giving you attitude? Have any of you have girls old enough to roll their eyes at you? Like, they start at like three, maybe? I mean, I think it's getting younger and younger. Maybe we did, I don't know, but like, it's pretty young. Can you control whether or not your child eats, cleans up, gets out of bed at night, comes into your room over and over and over and over again? Can you control whether or not, you can't control that. Can you control whether or not a child hits one of their siblings, comes to the table for kiddush? The answer is all totally you can't. Yet, how many of these things do we attempt nightly to control? You will come to the table for guys in the tables where there are parents running after their child for kiddush, as if it's like this is like their 4-year-old being at the table for kiddush, like everything rests. The future of the Jewish people rests on this little pizzola being at the table, quiet for kiddush. And like adults running around the table for kiddush. Now, we get very frustrated trying to control behaviors that we can't control. It's a pretty frustrating activity. Have you ever tried to control your spouse's behavior? It's like just as frustrating. I mean, you can't control someone else's behavior. You can't. We try. We usually get frustrated. And it doesn't really work out very well for us on any level. Yet, all of these behaviors that our children exhibit, which we very badly want to be like X, we really want them to be nice little children that listen to everything that we say the first time that we ask, and they say please and thank you, they clean up after them, they're like good adults, that's what we really want them to be. Guess what? It doesn't work that way. I mean, you'll figure that out already. But we try to control it in various methods, usually with anger, threats, warnings, or lectures, and it doesn't really work. So number one, the guiding principle is understand well the things that you can control and that you can't control. For example, can you control where your child has a temper tantrum? A little bit better, not always, but certainly in an easier method you can control where that temper tantrum happens as opposed to if it happens. So that we're going to get to in terms of what can I control, what can't I control, and therefore parenting accordingly to what it is that is within my powers to address. Okay, the second and the main guiding principle is as follows. And this is it's a simple thing, and there are many different elements of it which we will, Mirz Hashem, get to as we go along. The greatest way for a child or any person to learn is that they should learn from their own natural consequences of their decisions and their actions. Let life teach lessons. We don't need to teach it. Let life teach it. The natural consequences, that's a very important phrase which we'll get back to over and over again, that the natural consequences of their decisions should do the teaching. Simple example, just from as adults, just to bring the point home. When I leave my house to go to New York for any trip, which we do fairly regularly, I almost always will double and triple check that I have an easy pass, which I had for my days back in New York, which we keep in the house, before I go up to New York. Why do I always double and triple check if I have my easy pass with us before we leave the house? Because once I forgot it, and I had to wait online at every toll for the entire 2-week trip. over and over and over again. Well, if you waste the amount of time that I did because I forgot what happens the next time you go on a trip, you remember. Simple lesson learned, right? Made a mistake in this case, suffered the consequence. As a result of the consequence, I learned. I don't leave my house in the winter without gloves because I happen to have fingers which get very cold very easily, and it happens once or twice a winter, and I am freezing, and then my hands get all cut, and it takes me a week to recover. I check to have gloves because I once left without it, suffered the consequences. I learned. Our children are tremendous experimenters. They want to see everything. They want to be a scientist. They want to explore. They test every limit we give them. They want to see what's going on in the world, naturally. Shem gave them the greatest of gifts, that they are never satisfied with whatever they have. They want to know and see more. What's the best way for them to learn in life is let them experience the consequences of the decisions that they're making and see what happens. When the cost is low, when the price is not heavy, they can experience what happens if they don't prepare their shoes for the following day. Being late to school maybe is far less than being late to a job interview much later on in life where you learn. Let them experience. Let them live. Let them learn. Says Love and Logic, as far as what they say, you can't control everything. The things that you can control are the circumstances in which your children will make decisions. And based on the decisions that your children make, let them experience the natural consequences. Now, there's a significant difference. The first thing that I need to say is the difference between a natural consequence and a punishment. Punishments don't work very well, not for us as adults, and certainly not for children. When you get punished, you resent punishments. You just think about, how am I going to get back at whoever it was that levied this punishment? Natural consequence is a different story. As a simple example. Anyone here ever struggle with your children brushing their teeth at night? No? Everybody's expert? I mean, you can teach me how to do it. It doesn't work. It's a difficult process, getting children to brush their teeth at night. Why do we have to brush our children's teeth at night? They don't get cavities, right? I mean, that's why I have to brush our teeth, because if you don't brush your teeth, then you'll get cavities. You have to brush them. So it's not a task that either we as adults necessarily enjoy doing. Certainly our children do not enjoy doing it, but it's a necessary task that a child needs to do. So very often we know that we need to do it. They may know, but they don't care. So we end up with this job, this role of enforcer of human hygiene. We are going to take care of our children's teeth, right? That's what we need to do. So we chase them around, we corner them, we hold them, we do whatever we need to do in order to get their teeth brushed finally. Maybe we threaten, maybe we, whatever we do. What would be if, for example, you would simply walk into the bathroom and announce to your child, time to brush your teeth tonight, I'm here to help you. Child says, that's great. Goes off to the room and does whatever they normally do. You wait whatever appropriate amount of time would be, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, child doesn't come. Finished, done with brushing teeth for the night, no more battle, no more fight. I said it once, we're done. Move on to the next activity, be it reading a book, whatever normally happens in your bedtime routine, read a book, get ready for bed. At that point, the child invariably will say, wait a minute, I didn't brush my teeth, because anything to stall for time. At that point, they suddenly remember that's time to brush your teeth. But no, sorry, no more time left to brush your teeth. We're done with brushing our teeth for this evening. You didn't come, I called you, or we have to have a whole big fight, and I'm not interested in fighting with you anymore. Finish, we'll do it tomorrow night. Fine. Now, assuming that you're okay with your child going to bed at night without brushing your teeth, that's all the assumption that we're about to do. This is as an example to get things started. Now, the reason why we brush our teeth is because we're afraid the child's going to get cavities. What is the greatest cavity-inducing food? Right? Sweets, junk, ice cream, whatever it is that your kid likes to eat. Well, what do you do with a child who doesn't like to brush their teeth at night? Well, you need to be concerned that they're going to get cavities, so it would be totally inappropriate to put in their lunch the following day whatever snack they normally get, because if I can't trust my child to brush their teeth at night, then it wouldn't be responsible for me as a parent to give them sweet stuff if they're not going to be brushing their teeth. So a child comes home and doesn't have their snack, and they'll remember that. They're usually pretty good at that. Or if they don't get a snack in the lunch when they come home, they normally get a snack. Whatever it is, the next time they would have gotten a snack, and you very lovingly say, oh, sweet, I wish I really could give you ice cream, but I can't because brushing teeth is to prevent cavities, and ice cream is one of the great causes. And you don't like brushing your teeth, so I don't really think it's a good idea to give you ice cream today. They'll put up a big fight and a fuss. We'll get to that, handling that part later. What's going to happen that following evening when it comes time to brush your teeth and you walk into the bathroom and announce, time to brush your teeth, I'm here to help you? 9 out of 10, you'll hear a little pitter-patter of feet running to brush your teeth because they learned that brushing teeth or not brushing teeth has an impact on them. It affects me. Now, you don't need to give them a whole long lecture on brushing teeth. It's a very simple statement. Sweet foods cause cavities. That's why we brush our teeth. If you'd like to brush your teeth, I'm happy to give you sweets during the day. If I can't count on you to brush your teeth, I can't give you anything. And you're on their side. I really want to give you ice cream. I just can't if you're not going to be able to brush your teeth. You will not have a brushing teeth problem for very long, because who does it impact when they don't brush their teeth? Now, the whole goal here, and that's just an example, which you get to a bunch of others, is instead of a battle between you and your child, forcing them to brush your teeth, which again, as soon as you engage that battle, you have lost, is a matter of, I'm not going to engage this battle. This is the procedure. It's time to brush our teeth. If you don't want to, there will be a natural consequence of that. And it's sometimes not so simple. That's an example which is fairly straightforward exactly as to what the natural consequence has to be. It's not a punishment. Let's say you would say, oh, you didn't come to brush your teeth, I'm not reading you a book tonight. What does that have to do with anything? I didn't brush my teeth, you don't read me a book? That comes out as a punishment. And punishments just beget resentment. So it's not a punishment. Yeah?
So, you're saying the distinction between the reading the book and the sweets is that one natural consequence and one's not, and the natural consequence the kid won't have resentment for, but the unnatural consequence the kid would. So our four-year-old, I think it's just as abstract as a concept if I tell them, I'm sorry, I can't read you a story because you didn't brush your teeth tonight. Like, that would, I think, would make sense to him at the same level. If I said to him, I can't give you a sweet because it causes cavities and you didn't brush your teeth.
Okay, come here as a child. And that needs to be adjusted. The difficulty of this is getting a consequence that fits. That's really where the parental energy needs to come into. So if in that example that wouldn't work, then you need to find something else. You know, that's the theory is, I'm not levying a punishment. I'm actually on your side. I want to give you this. I just can't because of whatever circumstance in this particular example was. Let me give a couple more examples, and then we'll figure out. As children get a little bit older, they would that isn't such a disconnect. It's just a matter of each child is different when they begin to understand. Let me just throw out another example. You give your kid kid asks for a couple of orange juice. No problem. It's snack time. It's just the middle of the afternoon. You give him a couple of orange juice. They take a sip and they put it down right there. Now you're the parent, and you see he's got his book out. He's got his coloring, or just whatever, and you're like, okay, what do you do as a parent now? You got this big old cup of orange juice, and it's in one of those big cups, and you got all the stuff on the kitchen table, and there's another kid doing their homework, and like, isn't that? So what are your options as a parent? So what most of us probably do is either pick it up and move it, or instruct the child to move it. Something along those lines. So those are options. You know, moving it is fine. You haven't really taught the child anything. All you've done is you've walked around like a shadow over your child, making sure that they don't get hurt and don't do anything wrong, and which will be a frustrating existence for you as you continue doing that around the house. Or you've commanded the child to do something, move that away from the edge of the table. It's going to spill, something along those lines. Which, really, children don't like hearing that very much either. You know, that nagging voice in the back of their head, every single thing that they do, don't do that, move that away, it's going to fall. It gets very frustrating for us, and if you can imagine being the child hearing that, it's like, ugh, drives them crazy. What would it be if you said something along the lines of, cups that are at the edge of the table sometimes spill. Child hears that. Now they've gotten a piece of information, right? Now they could do a bunch of different things. They could move it. Most children will not do that. I don't think so. Most children would say, okay, I won't spill. Right? They're like adults, right? When we as adults hear someone say something like that, we say, that's nice. I won't do that because I'm better than that. So our children who are like us will probably do the same thing. Oh, okay, that's nice. I'll be careful. Well, what makes children is that they only can keep that in their head for about 10 seconds, so they probably were careful for the first 10 seconds, and then they got distracted by whatever, and sure enough, about 15 seconds later, there's a big old cup of orange juice on the floor. Now what happens? So I'm sure none of you would do this. Some parents would say, I told you that was going to happen. and they storm off to get paper towels, and they're mumbling under their breath, cleaning up this mess of their child. I can't believe that's the last time I give you a cup of orange juice. Something along that. It's a whole frustrating situation. I know none of you do this. It's funny to think about somebody doing that because it's so humorous, but it's obviously a ridiculous way to do anything. But now you have this big cup of orange juice on the floor, and your child has knocked it over, and you're thinking, I told you so. So what's the best way to handle that situation? Well, you made a statement. You said cups at the edge of tables often fall. Sometimes they spill. Child ignored it and spilled. Who's cleaning up this mess? Child's cleaning up the mess, right? Without question. And therefore, I know that right away going into the mess, I'm not getting involved. This is not my problem. Whose problem is this? This is my child's problem. Child's going to clean up my mess. Now, let's assume, just for the beginning, that the child actually does so. Child, sure, give the child a towel. You tell the child, these are where the towels are. I would suggest in my home, all the towels that are necessary for cleaning up spills are easily accessible to little four-year-old hands. Low down, make a mess. Not a problem. It's frustrating when we feel responsible for cleaning it up. Right? It's not really the 10 cents of orange juice that are on the floor that are so frustrating to us. It's that we have to clean up the spill. Well, guess what? You don't have to clean up the spill. And again, there are some more complicated examples. But here, I don't have to clean this up. This is my child's problem. That's where the towels are. These are the paper towels or whatever you need. You can clean it up. Let's say the child does so. Throws it out. Now the child asks for more orange juice because they spilled their first cup. So now here's where a true love and logic parent, every parent has to find their own way exactly how strict the rules would be, would be like, oh, I'm so sorry. I really wish I could give you a cup of orange juice, but I only like to pour one. We only get one cup of orange juice per day. Now, that's a strict approach, but that's within the confines of, you put it there, I reminded you that cups sometimes spill. There's a consequence to not being careful. You lose your orange juice. Now, in the house is a little different example. Let's say you're at Brewster's and that happens, and your kid's walking to the bench after you buy them an ice cream, and they're carrying their ice cream in a little precarious way that you see is going to spill, and you say, it's good to hold ice cream with two hands, or whatever it is that you say in an appropriate way. Child disregards that. Trips, falls, ice cream's on the floor. Are you buying your kid another ice cream? Well, that's the consequence. Isn't it great to learn that lesson over a cup of ice cream or a cup of orange juice as opposed to where we sometimes have this much longer? We make mistakes that cost us much more and we still think, oh, it's not a problem, I'll just get another one. It requires being careful. How a child will learn responsibility by experiencing responsibility. Responsibility is, here's your ice cream, this is yours, take good care of it. I'll give you the instructions as to what you need to take care of it, but the spill is your problem. Let's say the child refuses to clean up the spill. Orange juice all over the floor, and you're totally calm, no problem, here are the paper towels. Child looks at you, goes, and walks up to the playroom. Again, none of you would have a child that would do that, but imagine such a thing. Now here we would lose and we get angry and we'd run after the child. You clean up that mess right now. Pick up the child and hold them upside down where they can like use their head as a mop. Right? Not necessary. Not necessary. What would be a natural consequence of a child not cleaning up a spill of orange juice?
Anger.
Let's just rewind this for a few minutes. Anyway, once again, there's now a spill of orange juice on the floor. What's the natural consequence of that?
They can't have more orange juice.
Well, it could simply be, well, that's fine. When you're ready to clean that up, I'll be happy to give you another helping of food whenever that may be. This might be 3 o'clock in the afternoon, come supper time. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to have a cup of orange juice on the floor for a couple of hours, and I would be, it's worthwhile for me to keep my sanity. I'd rather have a couple of orange juice on the floor. I'm not getting involved in this. This is my child's problem. When you're ready to clean up the orange juice, I'll be happy to give you your next helping of food. It's totally in your balls, in your court. When you're ready, you're going to do it. I'm not going to force my child to sit there and clean up, but if you made a mess, responsibility requires you clean up the mess. When you're ready to clean it up, okay, because then, hey, you'll clean it up. I can wait because I'm serving dinner or I'm giving out snacks after dinner. And this is where natural consequences, we as parents, this is where we use a little bit of our being older, bigger, and badder. If we happen to know that we have a child playing in the playroom and is refusing to clean up the orange juice, and now again, if you have older siblings, it's easier. If you don't have siblings, it's just you. It's also easy. You just take out the ice cream from the freezer. And you're interested in giving out ice cream to the kids or to yourself or whatever. Everyone comes clamoring around, and it's totally fine. Absolutely. Everybody can get, oh, I'm sorry, there's still ice cream. There's still oranges on the floor. when you're ready to clean it up, then you could either say, again, every parent is different. I would be much harsher than my wife, and then I'm like, that's it for the afternoon. Our juice wasn't cleaned up, but other or they'll clean it up. But it's where they're learning. There's some form of a consequence where they can't get whatever it is that they next want to get. It's much more natural not to have to pull out the ice cream. Just whenever supper comes, it's just, you know, I can't give out food until everything is cleaned up. You do the same thing with cleaning up their room. I'm not interested in fighting with my child to clean up the playroom or cleaning up their room, cleaning up the bathroom, cleaning up anything. It's just a matter of coming up with what is the most natural response. And it can't be a punishment. And this is where a lot of times it takes a lot of thought. And this is where things are not so simple in the sense of what is natural. Well, if you didn't clean up your toys, what is the natural consequence? Well, it could either be I had to clean them up. When I have to clean up the toys are put away and you won't know where they are. Oh, you forgot to clean up your Legos? I asked you once, maybe twice, to clean up Legos. Legos weren't cleaned up. I had to clean them up that night. Well, when I clean up Legos, I put them away. Get where they are. Eventually they come back out because part of this is where the children have to learn and experience it again, but there's a period of time where it's not a problem. I'm not getting anyone to clean it up. That's fine. I can't have you playing with toys that are left out because it makes me really tired at night that I have to clean up your mess. So when I have to clean up your mess, so the toys get put away. Something along those lines, we could work on the exact details, and every family works differently in terms of the dynamics, exactly what the natural consequences are. But the theory, the idea, is simply in terms of the child learns that he or she makes decisions in life, and the decisions that he or she makes impact he or she and not anybody else. What often happens is the decisions that our children make affect us. They get us riled up. They get us frustrated. They cause a tumult in the home. And then what we've done is we've transferred the power, so to speak, of the home from the parents where it should be to the children who don't really know how to handle it or what to do with it. And all of a sudden they see, oh, when I do X, Y, or Z, I get a real rile out of mommy or daddy. Now, they're not doing it manipulatively. They're just children. That's what children do. They like to be in control. We like to be in control also. Well, so do they. And they see that they have that power. And as soon as they see that their efforts impact us, we've basically given over that control to the child. So it has to be where the child learns, I will make decisions in life, but it will impact only me and not anybody else. Let's give a bunch of some more examples. Just any questions on the theory?
Yeah, I feel a little bit like the child has control that way. For example, back to the orange juice.
Mm-hmm.
So if he spilled orange juice, and I say, well, if you don't clean up, you're not going to have, you know, the next Snapple.
But you don't ever say that.
Oh, so let's say like when snack comes.
Right.
Meanwhile, the snack wasn't going to be for another hour. Mm-hmm. And I have a one-year-old who runs around, and I'm always like, oh, don't go near the orange juice, don't go near the orange juice. And I have an orange juice sticky spill on the floor, driving me crazy, and he doesn't care. And then he says, oh, now I'm hungry. Okay, now clean it up, because now I'm hungry.
Okay, that's
so
fine.
Control that.
Excellent.
Situation.
So then in that kind of situation, which is totally fine, if the orange juice example is one that most of you would agree would have happened in that situation, that's totally fine. Then if you end up cleaning it up, what becomes the natural consequence of your having to clean up your child's mess? And just shift that and think, like, what makes it? And a lot of times, this is where parenting gets hard. Anything that I'm doing here, and I'm going to just say this again and again, is not to make it easy, is to shift where our energy is being spent from generally unproductive ways to more productive ways. So at the end, what would be, and I was like, my child spilled orange juice, refused to clean it up. No problem. I got to do it, because I'm not comfortable leaving orange juice on the floor. Fine. I now have to clean up my child's mess. What is the result of that when he eventually comes back to the table when he wants orange juice tomorrow, say, or later in the day? So then I'll be like, I'm sorry, we'd have to, you know, say that, I can't give you orange juice today because we had such a problem yesterday where it spilled and I had to clean it up and I'm too nervous to have to give you orange juice. I really want to give you orange juice, but it was so frustrating for me to clean it up. I'm not comfortable giving it to you again. Oh, but I'm not going to spill. I know you want. Tomorrow I'm sure you'll be better. And that day is lost, and then the following day. But it's just a matter of shifting, where because I have to do the energy, I'm not comfortable giving you orange juice today because remember what happened yesterday? I had to clean up your mess. I asked you to, and you didn't. I'm too nervous. I'm too tired now. This is a standard kind of response. I'm too tired now to have to clean up a spill, and since you decided yesterday that you don't like cleaning up spills, I'm not ready to give you orange juice today. Maybe tomorrow we could try again. It's just shifting what the consequence would be. Again, the orange juice was a bad example for that, but if he spilled, let's say, three cookies on the floor, or three jelly, whatever it may be, where it's less of that issue, So then it's easier to maintain that initial example. But I totally agree with you that every situation, will, you know, every day we'll have more opportunities, and every day we'll have different opportunities to work this through. Okay, let's do some more examples, and then just to sort of flush out the idea still in terms of what this is. Now, there are a bunch of different areas or arenas where this comes out. Again, the main theory is allow the child to have the ability to make decisions, but let them experience the consequences of the decision that they're making. So, for example, one of the arenas where this will happen is that where we create and set up the choices. Right? So we will provide them with the choices that they have to make their decision in life in, and then allow them to experience whatever consequences of their choices are. An example, child won't get out of the bath. Happens every night, child taking a bath, water's off, have there with a towel, and they are busy playing, they don't want to come out. Right? Happens before?
Once or twice.
Once or twice, it's happened. Now, inherently, I don't find that should be like such a big deal. It becomes a big deal because I got four other things that I got to do, and I can't spend 5 minutes fighting with my child to get out of the bath. Maybe I have another child in the bath. Maybe I just got other things to do. So it becomes this big deal, but I don't do that. So what are the possible choices that I could say if I have a child in the bath and is not coming out on time when I feel it's on time? So I would say, would you like me to help you get out of the bath and get into pajamas, or do you want to do that yourself tonight? Now, depending on your age of your child, I have some of them are old enough to handle that, and it's totally fine. Most of the time, they'll say, I'll do it myself. Great, no problem, no more fight. They are now in charge of picking out their pajamas, or if I pick them out for them, whatever needs to be done, and getting themselves dressed. Now you'll say, wait a minute, but that's going to take forever. No problem. Bedtime is the same time every night, regardless. That has to be part of the program. I mean, we'll have to work on that first. But if assuming that is worked out, this is the bedtime routine. And the key is to get a routine because that makes everything much more effective. The routine is we take a bath, whatever we do, get into pajamas, brush teeth, read a book, play a game, tell a story, whatever we do, and then it's bedtime. That time needs to be established. Obviously, no one is perfect to the minute, but a set time where if you finish the bath with your child, child's not coming out, you say, no problem. Did you want to do your pajamas yourself tonight? Would you like me to help you? So the first time, they're always going to say, oh, I'll do it myself. No problem. Child stays in their place. Maybe they make it out. Maybe they don't. Maybe they get dressed. Maybe they don't. But it certainly takes a whole lot longer, which is totally fine. But what they've basically done is they've chosen to spend that time getting out of the bath and getting into pajamas. When it comes time to read a book that night, it's a totally natural thing to say it took us so long to get into pajamas, we're out of time for our book, story, whatever pleasurable experience that the child would generally want. And we're going to get to this in a second, as long as it's not angry. It's, I'm on your side. I would have loved to have done that, but you decided, and as long as it's constantly part of the language, you decided to play that, which is great. I'm so glad you had a good time. I hope you enjoy playing in the bath. That's how we spent the evening, and it's totally fine. I'm not fighting you on coming out of the bath. Now, obviously, you're going to have to draw a line, because if they want to spend 3 hours in the bath, then there comes a time where you need to come in and physically take the kid and remove them from the bath. But that battle doesn't need to be a battle at first. And if you don't have a bedtime routine, you don't have story time, that's something which is needed to be created, because that's the easiest natural consequence for that particular example. But there are other ways to come up with others where the child is making a decision to spend the time in the bath as opposed to coming out and doing something that the child would like to do. Same thing with getting dressed in the morning. Depending on what age child you have, usually getting dressed is a preschool issue. I haven't found anyone of my children, when they get to kindergarten already, it's not an issue. But all the children in preschool have an issue of getting dressed in the morning. Are you comfortable taking your child to preschool in pajamas? This is an individual question. If you are, and your child's giving you a hard time getting dressed in the morning, well, then there's no more fight. Would you like to go to school in your pajamas, or would you like to go in your clothing? Are both of those options valid for you? Now, some parents would say, no, absolutely not. I'm not saying, well, then don't say that. Don't give an option that you're not comfortable living with, because they will catch you on it every single time. They know you better than you think. But if you're comfortable with that, if you are comfortable taking your child, then that's their choice. What do you want to do? Would you like? I'm creating the options for you. Would you like to go in your clothing? Would you like to go in your pajamas? And most children don't believe that you'll do it. But if you'll take their clothing and you put it in a bag, you put it in their backpack, and you start heading for the door, they will either change their mind really fast or they'll go in their pajamas. And if you're okay with that, then let's say you have a kid who's okay with going to school in their pajamas. They're okay with it. Are you okay with it? If you're okay with it, well then why are you fighting with your four-year-old to get dressed in the morning if you're okay with it? If you're not okay with it, if you think they're going to stay in pajamas their whole life and they're never going to outgrow it, and that you need to teach them now at four that this is a battle worth fighting, well then we'll find some different options. Most children are going to get to an age very quickly where they're the only ones in pajamas in school and they're not going to enjoy it. But why fight it at home where it's a battle and you're trying to run out to work, you're trying to get everybody out the door, you're trying to get them dressed and fed, and you're fighting with a four-year-old, a battle you don't have to fight because the consequence of not getting dressed is we'll teach it to themselves. Now, same thing with going to school or not, which is also an issue of can they stay home or can they not? The kids won't go, I'm not going to school today. Right, classic preschool stuff. I've had kindergartners who are, I'm just not going today. Well, that may or may not be an option to stay home. Most of the time, for most parents, that's not an option. So our two options are, well, are you coming to school or are you staying home? Because most kids will say, I'm staying home. And you're stuck. Well, I don't have anybody to watch you at home. I'm not staying home from work today. So those are not your two options. Whenever you present the two options to the kids, you have to be prepared to live with both of them. And it's a matter of... that's where some situations are tougher, and I'm just trying to paint the theory of it, and then each individual example is not so simple. That's really where a lot of the work comes into as parents, is coming up with what would be the most natural response. Okay, now that's something which in general we do, is constantly be coming up with choices that we create within the parameters of things that we are comfortable with. Are you comfortable, for example, with your children not eating dinner one night and going to sleep without eating supper? I am. What's the big deal? I don't eat supper for a night. I have a child who hasn't eaten supper in 3 years. Not because of my harsh parenting. He doesn't eat supper. They'll survive. They will definitely survive. So you have food on the table, and they say, yuck, I don't like this. Your options are now force feeding, becoming a restaurant, pleading, begging, doing whatever with your child to eat. How many of us have experiences regularly at dinner? Well, what happens if you don't? Okay, it's totally fine. You don't like this? You don't have to eat tonight. Plate is picked up. Dinner is done. Finished. There's no battle. If you're okay with them going a night without eating, that's the end of the story.
And then they come back to you later, 2 hours later, I'm hungry, and then they throw a fit.
Absolutely. And then we'll get to how to handle the fit. In other words, we haven't got to the how to handle the fit. But in other words, when you do that, you're preparing for a fit. In other words, I'm not going to force you to eat. This is what's for dinner. I'm not a restaurant. I don't have the strength, the energy, the resources to sit here every night. I personally, I find almost nothing as frustrating as dinner time where I have to make 5 different things for dinner. I can't. I just can't do it. So this is what's for dinner. If you don't like it, as long as if we're serving like something that like I understand why they wouldn't eat, then that's fair. But if this is a child-friendly dinner and you decide that you want scrambled eggs tonight, well, we're not making... I didn't see that on the menu. Tonight's menu is chicken nuggets. You don't want to eat it? Totally fine. But I'm not going to sit here just pleading, begging, letting them determine what I'm going to run around. Not going to happen. This is what's for dinner. Your choice. You can eat it or you cannot eat it. Now, if they decide they're going to throw a fit an hour later, we'll have to get to that as to how we handle the fit an hour later.
What about during... What does it say, like, during that? Like, if you're like... If you eat this, then you can have dessert, or you can have...
Right, so that's really a form of a threat.
Okay. So the bribery.
The form of a threat. In other words, you're bribing your child to do something, which, what's going to happen is if you're bribing a 3-year-old with dessert for chicken nuggets, you're going to be bribing a 4-year-old with, just keep on building that up to the point where you're then bribing your high schooler with, like, a new car to get to do well in school. Where the goal is... The child is going to make it that this is what's for dinner. I don't want to eat this for dinner. Okay, that's your choice. What are the consequences as a child makes a very small price to pay for learning this is what's for dinner. I could either eat it or I cannot eat it. I'm not going to fight with them. Let them learn that they go to bed hungry. I have had many children, some children many times, go to bed crying because they're hungry. But that's fine. I cannot and will not run my house that at dinner's at 6, and at 8 o'clock, three kids come into the kitchen. I'm hungry. We didn't eat at 6. And now I got... not happening.
How about the length of time?
Excellent. So the same... So no, this is a common thing I have...
A three-year-old...
To eat within 3 hours.
10 minutes or in 20 minutes.
For the same way, your 3 year old is
there are flies on her plate. She has not eaten.
I mean, generally,
what will happen if you
eat? Like, she eats her whole plate. If you don't fight with her eating, it's the length of time.
So that would be the same. In other words, if it's beyond reason, if it's beyond reason, and does she understand the concept? Like, if we take a 5 minute warning, is that something that she'd have any concept of? No, I don't mean warning. I'm just saying, like, dinner's for 5 minutes. Dinner's being served.
Not
in other words,
yet.
Like...
No, she doesn't understand time, you know, like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Not yet.
But even in the morning...
She's getting there.
Yeah, so that one's hard. Like, in my house, so my children who are now between the ages of, like, 5 and 9 regularly are 4 and 9 are not interested in coming to the table when dinner is served. They're busy playing. So I have spent hours of my life running after my children, trying to get them into the kitchen for dinner. Because... dinner is family time. We're going to talk about our day. This is important stuff, kids. Get in there. We need to bond. And it ends up being this battle, running around, getting them to sit down, and two of them sit, and two of them... So it's just a matter of food goes on the table, call goes into the playroom, dinner is being served for the next 20 minutes. My kids are a little bit older. They understand that concept. I'll go back in again once at the 10-minute mark, and my wife and I will enjoy a quiet dinner together, and nobody eats that night. And my kids will still tell you it happened once. They will still talk about, remember the time that none of us ate dinner? And now they come. They don't come right away. This is another important thing. Children are like us. When anyone here, the husbands can respond. When your wife says, can you take out the garbage? And you say, yeah. Does that mean you're going to get up right now and get garbage?
I'd take the garbage.
That means, yes, I'll do it. I'm in the middle of something. When I finish this, I'll do it. Thank you for the reminder. I'm on it. We rarely will, like, drop everything to go take care of what we just said we're going to do. So when we say to the kids, it's dinner time, and they say, yeah, and their little minds are also, like, not like, oh, okay, I was in the middle of this game, and in my little three-year-old's mind, like, this is my life right now, is this building this Lego project. Oh, dinner? Sure. Drop this and run into the kitchen. But they got the message, and they'll make their way in. So they don't come in at that moment, but they don't spend 20 minutes playing in the playroom anymore. And I don't have where they're going to come into the kitchen at 8 o'clock after the bath, after they're in bed, and then they come out and say, I'm hungry, because they know there is no way that they're getting anything to eat at 8 o'clock after dinner was done and started at 6:30. And the rule is you get up from the table, go back into the playroom, dinner is done. No, that was the other problem that we were having. They would eat, they'd go into the playroom, they'd come back, they'd go into the playroom, they'd come back. Dinner would take 4 hours, and it was just an impossible situation. There was no end. So they made a very simple rule. You leave the kitchen, dinner is over. That's how it works. They leave the kitchen, and they discover dinner's over. Now, they're making the decision. Oh, I forgot. You'll get a couple, I forgot. They'll claim they're good. Kids are really resourceful. They come up with great excuses. They have to go to the bathroom. They'll come up with stuff. And obviously, you can't be like entirely by the rules, but like that's how it goes. They know that when they come back 45 minutes later, like, where are my chicken nuggets? I'm so hungry. Like, yes, you left the table. Dinner's done. Daddy ate them. And that's it. I don't even get dinner. I just wait for the kids to walk so I can eat their supper and they learn the lesson. It's like over. But that's the main concern, because otherwise you will be running a soup kitchen for the next 3 hours as they one at a time come on in because they're still hungry. Now, part of what I want to, I'm going to be finishing up soon, what I want to say is, as much as love and logic holds that we're here to teach the children life lessons, responsibility that they learn, they make decisions and they live with the decisions. More than that, I find if they learn it, great. If they don't, it's also fine. It's I know how I'm handling situations. When I get into a situation with one of the kids, I know I'm not going to lose it. I'm going to be the one who's going to maintain my control of the situation, and I'm going to figure out a way that it becomes their problem and they're going to have to deal with it. So that even if they don't learn, and they never learn, they never come back to me 20 years from now and they say, you know, Dad, you really taught me responsibility by eating my chicken nuggets when I left. Thank you. Even if they never say that, and they never learn it. But you know what? I know what's happening in my house every single night. This is the rules. This is what's going on, and I'm not going to lose it. and that they go to bed screaming hunger, I always just remove them from my wife's earshot, because women can't deal with their kids claiming hunger. There's something that they just, that's something they're like, oh, they, I see like her, she just melts. Like a child saying, they're, my mother-in-law has been in the house, and she hears my four-year-old saying, I'm hungry. And she's like, you know, like foraging, like, what do you want? I'll give you anything. I'm like, please leave the house. Just get out. This is, like, men can handle that. Oh, you're hungry? Like, but we, these are the rules of the house, and you decided that you left the table. Like, I'm really sorry for you, and that's the way it goes. But like, hunger, like, food, if it doesn't work for you ladies, like, find something else. But, like, that's, you know, that's something, like, it happens every once in a while. This week I had a child who went to bed screaming at me that he was hungry. And you know what happened? He never came out of his bed. He just screamed himself to sleep. Because he learned he will gain nothing by coming out of his bed. Because he's not getting food at 8 o'clock when he didn't eat supper, and then thought he was going to get it at 8. So he learned that. So he was angry, which is, this isn't in his right. And he was hungry. That's within his right. But he cried himself to sleep. Now, you'll tell me I'm a horrible parent. But you know, but I don't. There's no parade, which doesn't do anyone any good, of a constant parade into the kitchen. Now, again, I mean, another, the procedure's a little bit harsh. That's why, like, the other method that we're going to get to is the soft, love, warm, fuzzy, how to speak to your children. This is just, how do you respond to a situation? Your child just hit his younger sibling. Now what do I do? What's the, like, how do I deal with the, I'm in the supermarket and my child throws a fit. My child throws a fit in the kitchen. So let me just give a couple more examples to round out, like, it sounds harsh, but what it is that we're trying to accomplish. Just for an example, child gives you attitude in the kitchen. I'm sure none of your children would ever do such a thing, but you're sitting there and, like, you just get one of those, you know, like, it's like, you're not old enough to talk to me like that kind of thing. But they just did. And now you don't even know how do I respond to a child that just spoke to me like that. So, in a calm manner, simply a matter of saying, I will respond to you when you talk to me with Derech Eretz. And you just ignore the child until they speak to you with Derech Eretz. I can't control whether or not my child talks to me with Derech Eretz. I can't control it. But I can control how I will respond to that. And the way that I will respond is, I will not respond to children who talk to me that way. When you're ready to talk to me with Derech Eretz, I will be happy to talk to you. And that's it. No fight, no battle. If you begin to lecture your child about attitude, or about how they should talk, or what it means to speak with Derech Eretz, you're not going to get anywhere. It's just a matter of, I can only control my response. I have a three-year-old who's kvetching in the kitchen. Same story. Usually my, you know, well, three-year-old's kvetching in the kitchen. Whining, kvetching, crying, and you can't handle it. Can I control whether or not my three-year-old whines in the kitchen? No, but it's driving me crazy. I can't control where my child does it. And in our house, we have a kvetch room. One of the kids' bedrooms is a designated kvetch room, and the simple choice is presented to the child. I understand that you'd like to kvetch. Would you like to kvetch in the kvetch room, or would you like to stay in the kitchen quietly? Whatever they're kvetching about, no problem. Pick him up, bring him into the kvetch room. And again, usually the kvetchers are young enough that you could pick him up. We're in the kvetch room, and then I present the option of, would you like me to stay here and kvetch with you, or would you like to kvetch by yourself? And I love kvetching. So I, by the time I get there, they're already laughing because they know they're going to get a good whine out of me, and it usually has to do with mommy. Mommy never gives me whatever they're kvetching about, but I can top them. But in the kvetch room, this is where we kvetch. So whenever there's whining in the kitchen, and it's just it's not a problem. I pick them. I say, would you like to stay here quietly? Would you like to kvetch in your room? You're more than happy to. Screaming, crying, there's a room for it. I put them in the room, and now it's their choice. I drop them in there. I either say, would you like me to stay? But it's always, I never force them to stay in. It's a matter of, when you're finished fetching, we would love to have you back in the kitchen with us. So they come back out. Sometimes they're finished, sometimes they're not. Oh, I see you're not done yet. No problem. Go back into the fetch room. It's in your terms. When you're finished, and you'd like to join us, we would love to have you. And it's just a matter of, this is how I'm responding, and that they're going to learn. They're in total control whether or not they can or can't stay. Again, this is talking about a kid who's old enough. You know, when you're old enough, when they're too old to pick up, then it's just a matter of, I will respond to you when you talk to me with Derech Eretz. when they're young enough where you can pick them up, then it's just a matter of the kitchen is the no kvetch zone. We kvetch in here. You're welcome to kvetch in here as long as you like. When you're done crying, when you're done kvetching, when you're done whining, I'd love to have you back. The choice is theirs. The impact is on them, not on the rest of the family. And when they're ready to come back out, you're welcome to have them. And the key is to always make a big deal when they come back out. Oh, I'm so excited that you've decided to join us. We're so happy to have you. Now, you may have to go back a couple of times, but it's, again, it will become known there is no kvetching in the kitchen. Kitchen is a no kvetch zone. This is where we do it. You want to do it? I'm not going to stop. I can't stop you from whining. I can just control where you're going to do it. Okay, questions, because I wanted to end by 9:30. Let's leave some time for some questions. There's much more to do still on this, but at least there's a starting point. Yeah?
Hitting somewhere down.
Someone knows, I see you decided you can't be around your siblings. You're going to, we'll go into your room. When you think you are ready to come out and play with the other kids, please come out and join us. I'm not going to stand there and hold the door. I'm not going to stand there and force you in there. I'm just going to put you in here. I'm going to take you out of the arena. Life is an arena. Their kids are learning that their actions have impact on themselves. Oh, everybody here is there. You can't be here. It's not a problem. I understand. You can't be with us right now. It's not safe for the other children. Put you in here. When you're ready to come back out, you're welcome to join us. They're going to come right back out, and that's great. Fabulous. Have another shot at it. I'm hoping you'll be ready to do it. I don't need to punish you and keep you in your room forever. For a certain amount of time. Sometimes, if it's worse, as kids get older, say, and I'll come get you when I'll come get you, and you'll tell me if you think you're ready. If you know, sometimes things are worse. But I'd rather, at least as a starting point, just put them in there. Say, I understand that you're angry or whatever is whatever level your child is in terms of how you want to speak to them about it. But it's that you can't be here with us because it's not safe for the other children. When you feel it's safe for the other children for you to be here, I'd love to have you come out and join us. And they'll come right back out, and you make the same big deal. I'm so glad you've decided that you're finished, you know, or you're not going to hit anybody anymore. Now, it will happen repetitively a couple of times. That's what children do. But eventually they're going, I can't stay. This is where I want to be. I don't want to be in my room by myself. I want to be with everybody else. Every time that happens, I get taken out. And learn, it's not worth it for me. I mean, again, a lot of times it's instinctive. But just like we learn when we do things a couple of times and it doesn't work out for us so well, we eventually learn to stop doing it. So when it's not anger and they don't get a real irk out of us, we don't give them a tremendous reaction, we just get a reaction of, oh, I see you decided that you're not ready to be here with everybody else. That's fine. Your room is a good place to be right now. When you feel you're ready to come out, we'd love to have you. Often will work. Again, as life goes on, sometimes it gets a little bit more complex and complicated, but that often we'll just do it in terms of learning. They know that I can't be around right now. But it impacts them more than everybody else.
We're having an issue right now with our to-be four-year-old. She's almost four, just making unsafe choices. In other words, like we've caught her the other week. She crawled into the five-month-old crib and propped him up, and then he banged his head because he can't sit up. So, and just lots of unsafe choices, climbing to the top of, you know, cabinets. And anyway, she's not doing it in a malicious way, and she's just making poor choices. But poor choices that can really, really hurt somebody.
Right.
And like, she picks up the baby, and I'll hear, you know, cry. And like, I have to eventually to go to the kitchen and get something without the two of them being alone, you know, and me frightened that they're alone in the room together. And she loves him dearly. She has never tried to hurt him purposefully.
No, 100%. So that's the kind of thing where, on a short term, in other words, let's say picking him up.
Uh-huh.
So, what's the little baby's name?
Judah.
So Judah's not for picking up right now. Whatever the statement would be that described this, that's not allowed. Then for a short time, he needs to be removed, or she needs to be removed. One or the other, whichever one's easier, probably him. Where she can't play with him for a short term, and then you give the test. And what I didn't get to was the way that it works is you give the, in very short, that was like the four steps, is you create the four steps of being like, this is the rule, Judah's not for picking up. Mm-hmm. Then you sit back and watch and wait for her to fail. I mean, like, that's what she'll do, that's how she'll learn. She fails, you're like keeping a watchful eye, you remove either her or him, depending on which one is easier given your circumstance, and then you give the task again. And then you put him down in front of her, keeping an eye out of the corner of your eye. This is like before you're comfortable going out to the kitchen for a while. Put him down again right in front of her and say, Judah's not for picking up. She probably will fail again. She'll try. And it's just a matter, and then you give her the task again, where the consequence is she can't play with him anymore, assuming that's what she wants to be doing right then and there. She can't be playing with him. And then you come back and are you ready to play with him again? Yeah.
I just don't want to create a sentence, especially with her being the oldest and blah, 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 and there's a nice big difference between them, is I don't want her to become resentful of the baby. I'm very upset because anytime I ever touch him, Ima gets upset, Ima gets, you know, because she makes poor choices around him that are not safe. So I just don't want it to become the particular situation, and I don't, in general, sibling rivalry is a very big deal.
So you need to give her.
She loves him.
So give her things she can do. In other words, you need to actively present her with these three things you can do with Judah.
Mm-hmm.
Set him up with toys, games. You can touch his feet. Whatever it is that this is not for. He's not for picking up. He is for, and give her the way to express that in that safe way. And you want to give her the task a couple of times while you're there, where it's not too dangerous, where she learns that when she does do what she's not supposed to do, she loses the ability to play with him.
Right.
Not so, but that's the idea. And you need to figure, but you give her the options to succeed, the things that she can do, and be prepared to remove her or him if she doesn't, I would say. Mm. Make sense? Agree? Disagree? It's a little bit harsh in some ways. So next week we'll go over a bunch of different areas of it, and in some ways I think we'll soften it a little bit, but the theory of it is just allow the child to learn from their own consequences. We maintain as parents our control, our calm over the situation. The child will experience life, learn from the consequences of their decisions where the decisions are easy for them to address, and then we'll... Okay, this is really just the start. We'll have to, next week, we'll continue developing this, and we'll start, hopefully, next week as well, the How to Talk so Kids Will Listen as well. Okay, any comments or things over, I'm happy, over email, anyone wants to give me a call or questions, so I can stay now for another 15 minutes if anybody wants to stay as well, but if anyone needed to go, I told everybody 9:30, and you are welcome to do so.
Stay.
Okay.